What we did find after doing some of that work is that we do see an increase around the middle of the cycle in ADHD symptoms. We've also seen increases in binge drinking middle of the cycle as well.
Are you overwhelmed by motherhood and barely keeping your head above water? Are you confused and frustrated by how all the other moms make it look so easy? You can't figure out how to manage the chaos in your mind, your home, or your family. I get you, mama. Parenting with ADHD is hard. Here is your permission slip to let go of the Pinterest-worthy visions of organization and structure fit for everyone else. Let's do life like our brains do life, creatively, lovingly, and with all our might. When we embrace who we are and how our brains work, we can figure out how to live our lives successfully, and in turn, lead our families well. At the end of the day, we just want to be good moms, but spoiler alert, you are already a great mom. ADHD does not mean you're doomed to be a hot mess, mama. You can rewrite your story from shame spiral to success story. And I'll be right here beside you to cheer you on. Welcome to Motherhood in ADHD. Hey there, successful mama. Welcome back. And today we're talking with Dr. Michelle Martel from the University of Kentucky. She's a clinical psychologist, so she not only works with patients on a regular basis, she's also teaching and training our clinicians of tomorrow, which gives me great hope because she is a wealth of knowledge. I found her when I was researching about women's hormones and ADHD, and she wrote a wonderful article from a study that she had done with some colleagues on how women's hormones are affecting our ADHD symptoms throughout the full menstrual cycle. We also touched on why this area doesn't have a lot of research that's gone on in the past, and what is she working on now? I took a lot of comfort in knowing that the research supports that as women with ADHD, we are struggling with so many big, scary monsters that come along with it, the comorbidities. It's not just ADHD that we're dealing with. There's the anxiety and the depression, the suicidal ideation, the binge drinking, the addiction, the eating disorders. Like, I'm really glad I can sit here and tell you that you're not alone, that this is a thing, and you are not the only one dealing with these big, ugly problems that come along with ADHD. Now, thankfully, Dr. Martel is also a mom, so she gets it. She shares with us some strategies that make sense for mom life and how can we decrease the mental load we're carrying? Because when we learn those skills, we can then turn around and teach them to our kids. So let's dive in because this is some good stuff and I can't wait for you to hear from Dr. Martel. Mamas, let's welcome Dr. Michelle Martel to the show. How are you doing this morning?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. So let me just start out with, can you just tell us a little bit about what you do on a daily basis and how you work with people that have ADHD in regular life?
So I'm a professor at the University of Kentucky, and I'm also what's called the director of clinical training in the psychology department, which means I train graduate students to do clinical work with people as well. But what the mamas out there may be most happy or excited to hear about is that I do some private practice work. I'm a licensed child clinical psychologist. And what that means is that I work with parents, kids, and adolescents who are dealing with all kinds of different mental health issues. My research area and my clinical practice focuses a lot on ADHD. But what a lot of people don't know is ADHD co-occurs with lots of other problems. It has one of the highest, what we call comorbidity rates, or just meaning it has one of the highest co-occurring disorders rates. So it often co-occurs with learning problems, mood problems, anxiety problems, conduct problems, kind of you name it. So I have a lot of experience treating all of those things. And by treating, I mean, I'm a psychologist, so I don't prescribe medication, although I do work with a lot of psychiatrists who do. So I can tell you a little bit about that, but mostly I do talk therapy, behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, family therapy. And I work a lot with parents with kids with ADHD and kids with ADHD themselves.
In all of your studies, what drew you into this area specifically with ADHD and mood disorders?
Yeah, so that's kind of a happy accident. I had this kind of interesting and bizarre interest, which I guess is a nice prelude to my new hormonal interest in what we call pediatric neuropsychology, which is just a fancy term for understanding brain behavior relationships in kids. And it just so happens that the guy that was my mentor in graduate school at Michigan State University, his main area of expertise was ADHD. And so I got all of my training in that particular area.
which is amazing. One of the greatest disappointments for people with ADHD is that this isn't something that's really talked a lot about in med school and training. So when women are going to like their general practitioner or even their psychiatrist or psychologist, they just don't have that experience to pull from. So I'm like, oh, bless you.
I think ADHD gets a bad rep. People sometimes, you know, people with ADHD are just lazy. I can tell you my research focuses a lot on that question and that's not true at all. People with ADHD, as you guys know, can look very different from one another. And so, you know, and obviously it's not that you can't focus or concentrate. It's just that it's a little harder. We know that attention, just like mood and depression and anxiety, it's all on a continuous scale. It's all a continuous dimension. So it's just that, you know, it might be a little bit trickier for some people to focus and concentrate, but it has nothing to do with your personality or with any, you know, your underlying morality or anything like that. That's ridiculous.
I was saying, I'm going to jump on that rabbit hole. What can we tell others who give us that feedback of you're just being lazy? Like, how can we explain it to them in a more confident way that it's not an issue of just being lazy and that it is a difference in the way that our brain functions?
Exactly. I often use the analogy like with depression, you know, people will sometimes say, oh, well, just be happier. Okay. You know, obviously everybody would like to be happier. Everyone would like to not struggle with focusing and concentrating, but in the same way that like anyone can have a bad day, right? Or anyone can have problems focusing on something in particular, right? Like your taxes, like how many people take their taxes out to be done? Because most of us aren't like, yay, let me spend half my day Saturday focusing on doing my taxes. It's the same thing. It's just that some people struggle a little bit more, just like people with depression have a bunch of bad days. People with ADHD tend to struggle to focus on more things. And let's face it, parenting and being a mom in particular, oh my gosh, it's like all the multitasking, all the focus, no break. So if there's a job that will like bring it out, parenting is a big one.
Yeah. And I think that's why we've seen such a prevalence of women coming forward is you take away a lot of the support systems that we've put in place. Even if we don't know we have ADHD, we put these coping mechanisms in place. And then the pandemic stripped away a lot of that support. And that's when women were like, I cannot keep up. It's too much.
Oh my gosh, the pandemic was terrible. It was like a free-for-all at my house. We had three kids here. My husband and I were both here. And even with both of us here, it was chaos.
Yeah, I was saying, I can head on that rabbit hole too, but I'll keep it on task for, I try to keep my episodes in a shorter time frame for ADHD brain. So I have a feeling that I could talk to you all day. So when we look at specifically the article that I had found when I was researching, was one that you were talking about hormones and ADHD symptoms. And I wanted to dive into that one a little bit first of just how do our hormones affect our symptoms? And I guess let me back up first. Like, how did you end up in that study first? Like, what even took you down that path to think, okay, this is something to address?
I was shocked that there hadn't been any work done in this area. I can tell you now that I've been doing it, I can speak better to why there was no work in this area. But I was trained originally in graduate school, working with people doing research on depression and eating disorder symptoms across the menstrual cycle. And that work has better established that there are hormonal effects on those kinds of behaviors. So as probably a lot of us know, often people would tend to get into a funk at the end of their menstrual cycle. You know, it's colloquially, in terms of lay people speak, you know, people will say, refer to it as PMS. There's actually a new clinical disorder for really severe forms of that problem called premenstrual dysphoric disorder or PMDD. And I have some colleagues who do some cutting edge work on that. So it's pretty well established at the end of the cycle when all your hormones are in free fall. Again, this is for people who aren't taking hormone medications or hormonal-based contraceptives like birth control. But if you're naturally cycling and you have that period at the end of your cycle, not to make a bad pun, but where all your hormones are declining, you may notice some changes in your mood. You may even notice that if you are on the pill, because the green placebo pills at the end of your pack the last week, those are just placebos. They don't have hormones. So you may have a sharp decline in all your hormones, even if you are on the pill. So, but that was pretty well established that, you know, we see these increases in depression at the end of the cycle. What's also fairly well established is that risk for eating disorders increases about midway through the second half of your cycle. So as your progesterone is increasing midway through what we call the luteal phase towards the end of the cycle, that can increase risk for eating problems. And again, if you're really observant about your own cycle and you're not on the pill or other kinds of hormone-based medications, you may notice that too. I don't know if you notice getting hungrier at the end of your cycle and wanting to eat junk food like chocolate. I do. And that can put you at risk for eating disorder symptoms because you'll have this tendency to eat more junk. And then if you're at risk for eating disorder symptoms, like you have a family history of that, then you may be at risk for purging or restricting or feeling, you know, overly bad about that. So that can increase your risk for those things. But what was really striking to me is there was no work done in the middle of the cycle around when people are ovulating, which based on theory, you might expect to see some differences in like risk-taking behaviors. And there was nothing done on the middle of the cycle, probably because the middle, like when people ovulate, is individual. So it can be hard to figure out when that's happening, aside from the lucky people who actually have those ovulation pains, which I think is a pretty rare thing. So there wasn't any attention to that. And I think part of that's because it's hard to figure out when that's happening for women. But yeah, I was just amazed that there was no work on things related to mood problems or eating disorder symptoms like inattention or problems concentrating or impulsivity, which you could very well expect to be affected by hormones. And so I can tell you, after having collected the data, which is really hard to collect because we collect every day for a month, we have people doing ovulation testing, we have people spitting in tubes for the hormones, we have people completing questionnaires every day. This data is super hard to collect, especially in samples that maybe are a little bit more impulsive or do have a little bit more problem concentrating and focusing. So we had to set up a lot of, you know, reminders and things. I can talk to you about the skill set.
That was one of my questions, is like, how did you do that?
Yes. So I can see, I mean, it was hard, I'll say. But what we did find after doing some of that work is that we do see an increase around the middle of the cycle in ADHD symptoms and in college, especially in college populations. Well, I shouldn't say especially, that's the population we're studying. So we've also seen increases in binge drinking middle of the cycle as well. So that may be specific to the undergrad population that we've been focusing on mostly just out of convenience. So but interestingly, the binge drinking is really linked with surges in estradiol mid-cycle, which is what is underpinning in large part ovulation, which makes sense in terms of development because around adolescence, we see increases in estrogen as people are going through puberty, which, you know, coincides with increased risk for drinking. ADHD, though, effects are a little different. We see those effects just post-ovulation as you see a sharp decline in estrogen. And then we see a smaller secondary increase in inattention at the end of the cycle when you're also seeing those mood effects. And what our current grant funding is looking at is whether or not the increase in inattention we see at the end of the cycle is because of this negative affect piece that I was talking about earlier, whereas the middle of the cycle effects are more an impulsivity type thing where it's affecting like cognition, like working memory and things like that. So stay tuned. We don't know the answer to that, but that's what our current grant funding is designed to test.
So I was like, I have about 15 questions on what you just said. So first of all, how did you get a whole bunch of ADHD women, especially, you know, a lot of them are in this college age bracket, to do all of these things for a whole month straight? Like that part alone, I was like, wow.
So yeah, our first study was actually not only on people with ADHD. We kind of sampled that whole attention continuum. So we did have a subgroup who had ADHD, and we found that the effects were actually stronger for women who were more impulsive or who had ADHD. Our current grant, though, is designed to really oversample women with ADHD. So, and to facilitate that more to your question is we pay people to participate, and it's based on how much data you're able to provide. And we let people know. So, you know, obviously we have this like incentive, like, you know, the carrot, but we also send a lot of reminders. So we get people to tell us what's the best way to reach them, text or email. We send daily reminders. If they miss a day, we will either send a follow-up or a call, because we can look at people's data as long as they provide data every few days. So we're not really concerned unless you go a few days without collecting data. So between the reminders and the money, we've been pretty successful, but it's still a challenge. And it's, I think, a challenge for the women completing it, right? I mean, it's a lot to do for at least 28 days, sometimes longer, because some people's cycles go longer. So
have you seen a pattern in what was more effective versus like people who were preferred the email or text, and whether or not one was actually more effective than the other?
Yeah, I think the text ended up being more effective, frankly, just because it's, I think, you know, people with their smartphones, right? Like they're more likely to see it. And we've also made all our tasks that you can do it from your smartphone, because we know people are on the go and they may not be able to sit down in front of their computer, that they can get online on their phone real quick and do things. And also keeping it short has been really helpful. We always want to collect more data than it's like practical to collect from people. So we try to keep our evening questionnaires to 20 minutes. You know, it's just the idea that no matter how busy you are, even if you're like out with friends or whatever, like you can still just check in with us and do our few little things. Like that makes us happy.
You also mentioned, you know, at the beginning you were like, how is there not more research done? But you're like, oh, well, now I know. Why is it that this area has been, I don't know if neglected is the right word, but maybe just not endeavored upon?
I think partly because it's hard to collect the data. You know, I think some people are like, oh, this would be interesting, but this is going to be so much work to like try to get people through this like long protocol, especially in this population. That's one big piece of it. Secondly, I think historically funding hasn't been good for this line of work. I mean, historically women health issues have, I don't want to say ignored, but have kind of just been neglected. But NIH, so the National Institute of Health, and specifically National Institute of Mental Health, which is where I get my funding from, for the most part, there's been a renewed emphasis on collecting that kind of data because they want attention to be focused on women, because obviously there are differences. There are some differences between men and women. You know, magnitude can be disputed, but you know, obviously the menstrual cycle is a big difference. And so they do want data on, you know, some of the unique challenges that women face, because there has been some recent data that even medication dosages might need to be titrated differentially based on biological sex and or hormones and things like that. And so I think that this really falls in that area.
And for someone who doesn't know the word titrate, what does that mean?
It just means it needs to be adjusted. You kind of like the idea of, you know, if you've taking your child in to get medication for ADHD, they'll start them on one dose and then they may like move them up gradually until they reach an effective dose. It's that idea. And the idea that, you know, you might've heard like drinking, men and women are differentially sensitive to alcohol. Women usually show effects at lower dosages or after having had less. So it's that idea too.
Okay. Before I move forward, is there any more like good, like tidbits we can pull from the studies that the women would benefit from? Cause I know we went through like, there's a lot of information. I know some people are like, oh, my head hurts, but
yeah,
like, I don't want to miss anything. Is there anything else more from like that work with the hormones and ADHD that we can pull from before I?
Yeah. I think the practical takeaways from the ADHD work is that there may be, especially if you're naturally cycling or not on medications that affect hormones, you may notice that you have more problems focusing at different points of your cycle. Our research suggests middle of your cycle, right after ovulation, and at the end of your cycle. So just, I think having that information or knowing that that's normal can be really helpful, because you know, you could make better use of like some of the strategies I can share with people for how to manage things better at those times. Also, my work doesn't directly address different important reproductive windows, at least not yet, but obvious next directions for this work is like, how does birth control affect this? I would expect, because it largely stabilizes your levels, it might improve your attention across most of the cycle, with the exception of possibly towards the end of the cycle, because you go on those placebo pills. But also it suggests that any times of your life where you are experiencing larger fluctuations in your hormones may be times where you're more at risk for ADHD-related symptoms. I mean, menopause comes to mind, because we do see these increases in attention when estrogen is declining, which happens when you're going through menopause. But also your pregnancy is a big unknown. I know, you know, people talk about pregnancy brain. I certainly remember feeling a hot mess during that period. So what our work suggests is you might see increase in attention, perhaps directly post-pregnancy, when again, you're seeing these large fluctuations. But what our work doesn't address is whether large increases in hormones, like what you see in pregnancy, might also affect attention. That's an unknown. So that's another important direction for future work.
Do you wish there was a way to feel confident about your day? To know exactly where you need to be, when you need to be there, and what you need to do today? I know what it's like to buy 15 different planners and not use any of them for more than a week or two. When you're tired of disappointing your family, your boss, and yourself. Imagine with me that tonight, when you look back at your day, you know that you did the things on your to-do list. You showed up well. You feel productive and accomplished. That's why I created Daily Planning for ADHD Moms, where I teach you how to keep a calendar and organize your to-do list. When you learn these skills from another ADHD brain in super short videos, they finally make sense. So now you'll be able to keep up with the commitments you've made and feel confident in how you're organizing your day. You'll walk away with an easy to stick to 3-step system to keep up with your calendar and a simple way to sort through the giant to-do list and figure out what actually matters. Plus, we have a weekly accountability group so you can ask questions when you're stuck and jump back on the wagon when you fall off. Because you will fall off. That's just part of ADHD. But now you will know how to prepare for that. So if you're ready to figure out your day in a way that makes sense both for mom life and an ADHD brain, I want to help you make this happen. Join me at bit.ly/ADHD plan. That's bit.ly/ADHDPLAN. It's all lowercase letters. I cannot wait to see you feel confident and competent in how you run your family life.
Yeah, I always tell people, like, usually the times that ADHD becomes more apparent is if you have a big life change. Like, you'll see in kids when they go from like elementary to middle, or middle to high school, or high school to college, that big transition where their whatever they had set up that worked for them now has to change. That's, or like for women, you're changing your job, as in now you're a mom, or a big responsibility at work. You'll see those times where it's like big red flags. And then the hormone shifts of puberty, pregnancy, postpartum, menopause. It's like, there's always another one.
That's right. Right. Is it like the only thing constant in life is change or something? Right.
Yes. So much so.
Especially for parents.
Yeah. And I know that's kids' job to grow and change, but it does make our jobs always different. So as soon as you think you might know what you're doing.
Yeah. Now you don't anymore. It keeps you humble. That's for sure.
Okay. So what can moms do to manage their ADHD better?
A lot of the strategies that I can talk specifically about for moms also work with kids, to the extent that you can either do it with your kid or do it for your kid when they're young, or teach them to do it for themselves as they're getting mm-hmm. older. One of the big ones is, to the extent possible, following routines. And I know this can be harder for people with ADHD than for people without ADHD, but to the extent that you can set things in stone in your routine, in stone meaning, you know, in like a year, you'll have to change it because your kid will need different things. But I always find, you know, as a parent, like the day-to-day just craziness, to the extent that you can put the important things in your routine, so much the better, because it's like less to remember, less to deal with. I packed the healthy lunch the night before, so it doesn't get lost in the chaos in the morning. I have kind of my mix and match healthy breakfast, kind of all that stuff bought and ready to go for the morning. Dinner, we have a few things in rotation. Bedtime routine is kind of critical, frankly, for my mental health. You know, just this idea of like having a bath, you know, to wind down, like doing book time in the evening, last trip to the potty, you know, maybe a few sips of water, but, you know, then taking the cup out of the room, not leaving the toys in the room. Like, so, you know, those things, to the extent that you can, whatever works for your child and your family, having that all set, I think is really helpful. And ditto for me, like, frankly, it's not uncommon for me to forget my lunch. You know, again, I try to do all the same things, like put my lunch aside, so I am less likely to forget it, things like that. So following a routine is a big tip I can give people.
I'm just going to let everyone know that I did not tell her to say that, because that's actually what I do, is I teach classes to moms on how to follow routines, like how to keep up with all that mom stuff. So just so you know, she did not know that. And I didn't tell her.
I had no idea.
But also a great endorsement.
I mean, I think too, you know, it's hard to like find the time to like be thoughtful about it, but whatever time you put into that, it will pay dividends. Like, you know, I mean, like weekly grocery trip is designed for me around the routine. So it really does help during the week, you know, to do that. Another big thing is using different tricks for helping to remember things. So, I mean, I use, and again, whatever works for you is the best thing. But for me, I use a lot of reminders and notes on my phone. You know, I set alarm reminders. I use my calendar. I have the ongoing grocery list in the notes section. So anything you can do like that to like take the load off your brain and having to keep these things in your mind all the time, I think is really helpful. Even to the point where I have like a set aside time to go to the groceries. I, you know, have my ongoing list. You know, I have my list of reminders for work. I have the 15 minute before whatever's happening reminder to go off on my phone. Sometimes I set a bedtime reminder because, you know, time will get away from all of us. So those kinds of things. And then the last suggestion I have is, you know, in terms of main suggestions, is to break big things down into small things. I think everyone struggles with, but perhaps particularly people with ADHD, is feeling overwhelmed by the magnitude of the task you have in front of you. And so I find if I can just get started on a small part of it, again, just thinking about breaking it down into smaller things, you know, that can be really, really helpful. You know, like teaching your kid to read, you know, that's like too big of a goal, right? But you could do like a small book or two a night and point out certain words you want them to learn. So like breaking things down into smaller chunks that feel manageable for you is going to make it easier for you to feel like you're making progress. And frankly, raising kids is like one nonstop big task, right? Like you want them to like have manners and go to bed on time and learn potty training and learn how to read. And, you know, if you think about it in that way, you just feel totally overwhelmed and sit and cry in the corner all the time. So instead, if you're like, okay, we're going to try to at least be in bed by this time, and we're going to read two books, you know, and I'm going to remind them to say please a few times, like, okay, you're working towards the goal. It's all good.
Yeah. I think that's one of the hardest parts about having ADHD is that we have this like all or nothing mindset. And so we feel like if we embark upon a project, we have to finish the entire thing right now. And it may literally not even be possible, even if you wanted to, but it takes a lot of practice to get into that habit of looking at it in pieces. And then our brain can kind of get behind like, okay, instead of trying to, the idea of teaching our kid to read is like so big. Like how do I even go about that? If you're looking at it as like, well, how about we just start with like, when we read the book, I point to the words as we go so that they start to recognize that like these squiggly lines mean that I'm saying this word. Even those little things, that little goal is still a very worthy goal. And you're still doing great things for your kids, even though they don't know how to read tomorrow.
That's right. I know. I feel like parenting is all like that. People are like, my kid needs to do all these things right now. I'm like, well, they will do all those things, but they will not do them all right now. That's too much. So like pick like three small things that you're going to work on for the next few weeks. And then in a few weeks or a month or two, you may be like, okay, they've got the bedtime thing is going pretty well. We can move on to moving the bedtime earlier or having them start getting their clothes out themselves. You know, like you could move on to something else, but for the short term, you just got to pick small things on the path towards the big goals. That's parenting forever. It's just the goalposts keep moving. Hopefully they keep moving.
Yeah.
Sometimes they stand still for a while, and that's okay too.
That is a good reminder. Yeah. We're always pushing forward and everyone moves at their own pace. It's okay if we pause and
oh yeah. My daughter is like always like she, you'll think, you know, am I making any progress here? What am I doing? And then 2 months later, all of a sudden she's got it, which clearly she was like getting it. She just wasn't showing me she was getting it. So I just have to now be like, I have faith that she's actually getting more than it looks like. And one day she'll surprise me and just do it all. But
I would say it's like an amazing thing, but also a frustrating thing about watching kids learn. I mean,
I'm like, if you could just show me, like, I'm doing something.
Give me a little feedback here.
Need that reinforcement.
Yes. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, you know, like they're the same height. And all of a sudden they grow 2 inches. I feel like it's the same way in their brain development. It's like, are we getting anything done here? And then all of a sudden they've got it. And it like, oh, okay.
I can say one strategy that underused, but I think is super helpful, especially helpful if you're parenting a child with ADHD, is frequent reinforcement. It doesn't have to be like stuff. It can just be like, great job. I noticed that you picked out your clothes today, or I noticed that you picked up that book on your own to look at it. And that's something I think parents are particularly bad at for themselves, but I think particularly helpful for all parents, but also helpful for parents with ADHD, remembering to reward yourself too. Like, you know, I did a good job today. Like my kids survived for another day. Way to go, self. Like after my kids go to bed, like maybe I can do something nice for myself, like a bubble bath or reading a book for pleasure or having a glass of wine or whatever does it for you. Because I think parents forget, or we don't have time to do those things, but it's very important to reinforce yourself because you're doing a really difficult job right now with no vacations or
break. No paid time off, that's for sure.
That's right.
So the women in the ADHD community know that this area is so worthy of investigation and research. And is there anything that we can do as a community to be supportive and encourage these kinds of studies to happen? Because like from an outsider's perspective, I have no idea how all this happens and the nuts and bolts. Like, is there anything we can do to be supportive in getting these things accomplished?
Yeah. So national grant funding agencies like the National Institute of Health, also National Institute of Drug Abuse funds some of my work, National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Most of it falls under NIH. So National Institutes of Health, they actually are paid directly by your tax dollars. So you can reach out to your Congress people and like let them know that you want this kind of work funded. That's probably your best kind of direct route. Probably these organizations accept donations. I'm not sure. You could think about that. You could also obviously think about if there are research studies in your area that you see advertised. Sometimes we advertise over Craigslist or Facebook or Instagram or through university forums. If you can sign up to participate, that's like a huge help as well.
Is there some kind of like a central place where you could go and be like, here's all the ADHD studies. Can I participate in any? Or is it just like, I have to like filter through Craigslist for a while?
I think you can do a search just for ADHD research, okay. Maybe. Research studies. Yeah.
All right. As we wrap up, I'm like, I could ask you 100 more questions, but trying to watch my time, which is not a talent of ADHD people, something I have to work really hard on. I want to ask you a couple of my lightning round questions. All you have to do is just answer. You don't have to explain anything if you don't want. You can just answer. If you want to explain, you can. But okay, question number one. The best thing that I've read or listened to recently is?
I like to read for pleasure. So, and I really like teen fantasy. So I'm reading a book right now that's really good. It has like a villainous female badass main character. The Shadows Between Us, I believe is what it's called. I'm super enjoying it. But that's kind of my jam. So.
Oh no, I love young adult fiction. It's like such an easy read and it's fun and enjoyable. Okay. My most boring about me fact is?
I really get up in the morning for my coffee.
Number three, when I'm having a rough day, my go-to quote, song, poem, book, activity, whatever is?
I really like Hyperbole and a Half. It's a blog, but there's also a book or two by her now about mental health issues, really focuses on depression. And she's got a great sense of humor.
And number four, don't tell anyone
I really enjoy terrible music and terrible TV because I obviously also in my reading like to escape life, not experience more life.
There's got to be a balance. Got to have a balance. Okay. Number five, if I had a magic fairy wand for one spell, I would
have to make mental health services more readily available to everyone. I do some consultation on an inpatient unit and it's just sad to me that so many kids who really need services fall through the cracks.
And number six, my best piece of advice for mamas with ADHD is?
Be kind to yourself. It is so hard, even without ADHD, and especially with ADHD. Yeah. Parenting is just really, really hard. It taps at all the weak parts. So I like to think that you come out stronger, but that doesn't help with the day-to-day sometimes. So just hang in there. You know, you're doing a great job. Keep up the good work. Keep trying to improve. Okay. But know that you're enough just as you are.
I say that is a beautiful way to wrap up. For the mamas that want to find you and read your work and learn more about what you're doing, how can they find you?
Probably the best way to reach me is email. And it's just my first name, period, my last name, all lowercase at uky.edu.
Well, thank you so much. That was awesome. And I could pick your brain for another 4 hours, but I promised 45 minutes. So thank you. I really appreciate it. Such a treat to chat with you. So thank you.
It's a pleasure.
For more resources, classes, and community, head over to my website, motherhoodinadhd.com.